Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Vice President J.D. Vance touts the sweeping federal budget bill in La Crosse. Plus, the Republican Party of Wisconsin concludes it needs to court more out-of-state donors. And a federal judge says the criminal case against Milwaukee Judge Hannah Dugan can move forward. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 29th. I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we have something we don't get to do very often on Rewind, but we get to break some news right now. We just got word that Justice Rebecca Bradley will not be seeking re-election. This kind of puts to bed speculation that's been going on for a couple of weeks since it turned out that she had not raised any money in her campaign finance reports earlier this summer. She released a statement saying the conservative movement needs to take stock of its failures, identify the problem, and fix it. I will not seek re-election to the Wisconsin Supreme Court because I believe the best path for me is to rebuild the conservative movement and fight for liberty is to rebuild the conservative movement and fight for liberty is not as a minority member of the court. So what do we make of all of this? Again, we got word of this just a couple moments ago.
So let's break it all down into pieces. So one, she told me in April, right after liberal Susan Crawford won a 10-year term, cementing the liberal majority for at least 2028, she was going to run for election. She's going to take the coming weeks to figure out the best path to do that and to prevent a liberal siege, essentially, on the state Supreme Court. Then things kind of got quiet. And this summer, kind of like mid-June-ish, there was kind of like this rumbling of things had taken a turn for the worse, that she was had a negative vibe about her viability because she was realizing the challenge for a conservative to win in a spring electorate right now. It hasn't been good. Go back to 2017 when Trump first became president. Liberals have won every Supreme Court race that was contested except for one, as Brian Hagler in 2019. That has flipped the court from 5-2 for conservatives to 4-3 for liberals. And again, they secured the majority at least 2028. So the reality was, is there a path financially and electorally to win for a conservative? That was one question. Then like about, I don't know, a month ago, chatter picked up that she was talking to donors, talking to operatives, trying to feel out, are you going to be there for me? Is there a path? Like really kind of putting the nose to grindstone, can I pull this off? And the conclusion is obviously not. And so that first part of the statement, saying about the conservative movement, what she means indictment of, we have a problem as conservatives. We can't win or rarely win off your elections without when Donald Trump's not in the ballot and the Trump age. Now, there are exceptions. Hagedorn won obviously in 2019. If you go back through the non-presidential elections, you know, Ron Johnson in 2022 won narrowly re-election bid for U.S. Senate. John Leiber, surprise victory for treasurer in 2022. And who else? It's been Trump. Trump drives everything. So without Trump on the ballot, how do you get Trump voters out? So there's that piece of it. Now, the best place to go fight is not a minority member of the minority of the Supreme Court. That's a nod to the fact that there's not a path majority for at least a couple of years. That's only if you're conservative, you hold the seat in 26, that's Bradley's, she's giving up. Hold the seat in 27, that's Annette Ziegler's, that we don't know what she's gonna do. And then you have a shot in 2028, Rebecca Dowell would be up. So there is a heavy slog to go for having a shot to even flip the court. So now the question becomes, what's the alternative? Okay, Chris Taylor, appeals court judge in Madison, the 4th District. She's already announced she's running, already raised $500,000 plus in the first month of her campaign. I talked to Maria Lazar, who's an appeals court judge in the 2nd District out of Waukesha County. She's going to consider it. Others will kick the tires, but they'll have the same question that Bradley did of what's a viable path to win in this environment. And talk to Republicans, they're not sure right now what that viable path is. Now, for liberals, they're like, hey, this is great news because Rebecca Bradley is an incumbent justice who is a proven winner and lights the conservative legal minds on fire with her dissents and her writings. even she's saying, I can't win. If she can't win, what's your alternative? Now, the one alternative theory I've heard from liberals is, you know, Chris Taylor is former Democratic lawmaker, foreign policy advisor for Planned Parenthood, deep voting record in the assembly as a Democrat. So there's a record there you can go after as her being liberal. Maybe you could find a more moderate Republican to run as an alternative, but you know, that's a big if right now. So we're looking at a situation where I don't see the white flags being raised, but this is for conservatives a troubling moment where you've got an incumbent who, again, is a hero for conservatives legally, is saying, I'm not doing this.
And we're going to speak a little bit later in the show about this report from the Republican Party kind of looking very closely at these April elections, or as you mentioned, the liberal justice won by 10 points the last two elections. And so they really kind of looked at what can we be doing in these off-year elections, in elections that do not have Trump at the top of the ticket. But April was supposed to be a little bit of a testing ground for some of these tactics for Republicans and conservatives. And so now this sets up an open race. And so we'll really be kind of watching to see what emerges. And of course, like looking to see what kind of candidates come forward. And so this has really kind of thrown a pretty surprising wrench into what we're looking for going into the fall.
It almost though felt like the second the vibes are coming out about how do you win, that we were going to reach this conclusion. Like there was that moment of, oh, there maybe was a path, you know, about a month ago, but it never took into account the reality of like what spring electorates look like right now. Republicans will tell you they start out down 5 points like from the get-go in April election. And if you look through the history of these Supreme Court races, Crawford won by 10 points this April. Jenna Prosevich, 10 points April 2023. But Jill Karoski won by 10 points. And Rebecca Dowell won by 10 points. Like there's a theme there and each one's different. 2018, Rebecca Dowell was kind of one of the first signs of that blue wave we saw nationally, right? The pushback against Trump. In 2020, you had a contested primary for president on the Democratic side, but not the Republicans. That helped boost turnout, helped Karoski. 23 was a referendum on abortion and redistricting. And then 2025 was this kind of push to hold the court, and then Elon Musk got involved, right? The Trump thing again. So each has a different flavor, but the same result. So what do you do differently if you're a conservative?
Yeah, so definitely lots for us to be kind of paying attention to in the coming weeks. And also just to digest in this news, I think we'll be seeing more reporting kind of coming out over the coming hours even. But speaking of elections, you know, we are also more than 14 months out from the midterm elections, and yet we experienced a little bit of early campaigning in the form of Vice President J.D. Vance coming to La Crosse yesterday. He was there to kind of ostensibly to speak about the big, beautiful bill, the Trump mega bill, but also, you know, notably, he was in Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district, where Derek Van Orden is going to be up for reelection. In his speech, he focused on the impact of on manufacturing and small business in America, and we'll just look at a little bit of video of his visit right now.
What the working families' tax cuts did is very simple, ladies and gentlemen. It let you keep more money in your pocket. It rewarded you for building a business or working at a business right here in the United States of America. It makes it easy for you to take home more of your hard-earned pay, and it makes it easier. If you're an American manufacturer or an American business, it makes it easier for you to build your facility or expand your facility right here in the United States of America. If you're building in the United States of America, if you're working in the United States of America, if you're trying to earn a decent living right here at home, we are going to fight for you every single day. But if you build crap overseas and try to undercut the wages of American workers, you're going to pay a big fat tariff before you bring it back in to the United States of America.
So yeah, really that focus on the impact on manufacturing sector. He was at a steel fabrication shop in La Crosse and kind of talking about small business. But this comes as this bill has been like relatively unpopular among people, its effects on taxes and other kinds of things. So what was the message that you heard from his speech, and how does that kind of compare to what else has been playing out?
They're trying to flip the narrative. So there was a poll from Pew Research, I think in mid-August, found nationally a plurality of adults disapproved of the bill, and there are things that they're unhappy with. You know, the talk about Medicaid, what's going to happen to these programs, food stamps, taxes, the tax breaks, are they skewed toward the wealthy? What's going to happen to the deficit? All these things are kind of like issues for Republicans. They're trying their best to rebrand it as not one big beautiful bill, but one big beautiful tax break. And if you listen to his speech yesterday, a lot of it was about the average tax cut for, you know, blue-collar workers, how you're going to have more take-home pay, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. No, not quite no tax on overtime. There are some limits there. We're not a financial show, so I'm not going to get into the details of all that. But, you know, there are attractive lines to say, look, if you're a working-class voter, this is going to be good for you. Now, the challenge is always when you have something like this, you talk about the average tax cut. They're talking about the White House, the average reduction for a family of four is $10,000. I have a family of four. I'm not expecting a $10,000 break on my federal taxes this next year, because that average takes into account everybody from the top to the bottom, right? And the average skews things. But, you know, they're also talking about you're locking in tax cuts that were going to expire. So I'm not getting a relief, right? I'm giving the same tax breaks that I have from 2017 continuing, plus some other changes that might benefit my tax bill. So I'm watching is come 2026, when you get your federal tax bill back and you calculate your taxes, are you really farther ahead than you were before? That'll be something that people will feel. You know, is it really true, this big impact? But for Republicans, you have to try and rebrand it, because you're losing the kind of the PR game right now. So how do you change that narrative? This is one way. And then two, he tried to kind of do a preemptive a defense against the coming attacks on the healthcare stuff, saying, look, Democrats, they're not concerned about healthcare except for people who are not here legally. They're so intent on making sure people without documentation get healthcare, they're going to vote against these tax breaks for you, the working class. They're against you. That's kind of the message here, trying to flip things on Democrats.
Yeah, and then the other way that he kind of spoke in those broad terms a little bit was when asked questions about the National Guard being deployed mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. So obviously that's been going on for a couple of weeks. Escalated a little bit this week with the signing of an executive order kind of expanding the president's authority to potentially activate units in all 50 states. He's flirted with the idea of deploying troops to, or guard units, I should say, to Chicago and other places. And so that raised the question, well, could that happen in Milwaukee? And he didn't really directly answer that. He said, well, we believe we have the federal authority to do so, but we would like to be invited. Mm-hmm. So again, speaking in these kind of broad strokes to preemptively perhaps defend against some of these questions.
And so it's all tied together that you should be safe. You should be able to go out, you know, if you work overtime, the government keeps its hand out of your damn pocket, I think, or something like, keep the hell out of your pocket. You know, you should be able to safely go out for dinner with your family. That these are things that you want. And these places like Milwaukee and Washington, D.C. and Chicago, they're not safe. We want to make them safe again for everybody so you can live this kind of prosperous life.
And then again, you know, kind of hanging over all of this was the re-election campaign of Derek Van Orden. So there was a little bit, he didn't speak directly. He addressed the crowd beforehand, but he didn't get up on the podium and speak. He did some, you know, handshaking and that kind of thing. But beforehand, before J.D. Vance spoke, the Secretary of the Interior spoke, and he made a point of saying Derek Van Orden voted for this bill that, you know, gave you all of these tax breaks and all of this kind of thing. So that's very much in the air. And then, of course, Bernie Sanders was in Viroqua in the same congressional district over the weekend advocating for Democrat Rebecca Cook. And so we are seeing, again, more than 14 months out from the midterm elections, things really start to heat up. And so it felt a little bit like campaign season in August of 2025.
It never ends in Wisconsin.
Sure doesn't. Yeah. So we will be, I think, continuing to travel out west quite a bit over the next couple of months. On the other side of kind of the conversation of the Trump mega bill was that the Evers administration kind of released their own analysis of what the financial costs will be. And so, again, kind of in opposition to some of those claims that Vice President Vance was making, this particular analysis found that it will cost Wisconsin $142 million per year. They and DHS both sort of say that this will require about $70 million to cover sort of immediate administrative costs, about $69.2 million, could remove 270,000 people from health care, and then that a lot of other outcomes are unknown because states are still awaiting federal guidance. And so speaking of sort of the Republican spin on the bill, this is the Democratic response.
Yeah, and noteworthy that the White House, after seeing the Evers analysis, put out this release to reporters saying, hey, you should consider this, and they talked about tax cuts. They want to talk about the tax breaks in this bill. Now, interesting note, the governor put out there, Legislative Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan budget arm legislature, in July, put out, end of July, this memo saying, we can't really tell you how much it's going to cost or how much it's going to impact Wisconsin because we're waiting for guidance on how to implement these things. So until you get that, it's kind of hard to put a price tag on it. But Evers folks felt comfortable making a calculation, and this is their analysis of like what it's going to cost taxpayers and let these things. We shall see.
And again, difference in focus, you know, Republicans really focusing on the tax aspect of things, Democrats focusing more on cuts to Medicaid, cuts to food assistance, that kind of thing, and of course, health insurance. And so it'll be a little bit of a battle of those spins as well. Coming through the legislature, we had a number of Democratic legislative packages kind of released this week. And so to go through them a little bit quickly, the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Bill introduction, this would reauthorize that conservation program at $72 million a year for 6 years, and it contrasted a little bit to a GOP attempt to save the same program. We have a little bit of video of that launch.
And while I sincerely appreciate the effort and good intentions put forth by Representative Kurtz and Senator Teston in crafting their Knowles-Nelson bill, I fear that the oversight process laid out in their AB 315 is simply unworkable. This is why we have given so much thought in our bill to establishing a new Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Board, modeled after other successful Wisconsin statewide councils, to provide the oversight needed, but in a timely, transparent way, and without the time-consuming and oftentimes partisan gridlock of the legislature.
So there was this fight all through budget season over whether or not the budget would include funds for Knowles-Nelson. Didn't. Then Republicans came out with their version of a bill. Obviously, Democrats just came out with their own proposal. What do you think is going to kind of flesh out here?
Okay, so remember, the program is authorized through 2026. Republicans have a problem with the program. That is, the state Supreme Court ruled lawmakers, you can't authorize funding for the program and then, after putting the budget, come back and block purchases. This is that ruling 6-1 last summer. Republicans will tell you, if there's no legislative oversight, we're not going to do this program, period. Devin Lemieux told me that 7 years earlier, said that if there's no oversight, there's no program. So Tony Kurtz in the Assembly, Pat Teston in the Senate, they've been trying to craft a bill that will get Republican support that they feel comfortable with, because there are concerns from Republicans, especially up north, about the amount of property, for example, in some counties that are in stewardship. If it's in stewardship, you can't develop it. You can't develop it, you can't get property taxes off of it. That's an issue for northern counties, right? So how do you get Republicans on board? Because we've talked before, leaders are not going to pass bills unless Republicans can pass them on their own. So they want to do that. Well, then too, you have now this Democratic proposal that's competing. Democrats saying that bill's not workable. So what are they going to do, the Democrats, if Republicans do find an agreement and pass something? Are they going to get on board? And then what's the governor going to do? So it's kind of a mess right now for stewardship, and a very murky future in the immediate term for how this program is going to survive.
And like you say, they have till 2026, till next summer, basically, to try to figure this out. At the same time this week, we also got a package of gun safety legislation. This would prohibit firearms from college campuses, very much timed with this horrible shooting in Minneapolis. And so that was some of the way that it was framed this week. And then also Democrats released a legislative package called the Keep Families Together, which would fund immigration defense work, prevent government actors from acting while masked and unidentified. So we've been seeing, obviously, a lot of videos and photos of ICE agents and people working for immigration enforcement with face coverings, prohibit the use of state, county, or city facilities for detaining people based solely on their immigration status. And then what I thought was kind of particularly interesting, ban agreements appropriating local government resources for immigration enforcement. That is kind of aimed at these 287G agreements, which at least 13 Wisconsin counties already participate in, and Republicans have passed a bill essentially saying all county sheriffs would need to participate in that. That hasn't moved forward yet, but it did pass the legislature.
Here's the thing. These bills are all written by Democrats. Republicans control both houses. They're not going anywhere.
Right. That is sort of the the moral of the story from the legislature this week. We also have some update from the courts in the case of Hannah Dugan, this Milwaukee judge who faces criminal charges for letting an unauthorized migrant leave through a door of her courtroom. She is facing criminal charges of helping a man evade immigration agents in April. In May, a grand jury found that she could be indicted on charges of obstructing or impeding a proceeding and concealing an individual to prevent his discovery and arrest. Charge language. And then on Tuesday, that indictment went before a U.S. district judge who rejected a motion from her lawyers trying to say that she has immunity. He said, U.S. District Judge Lynn Edelman said, There is no basis for granting immunity simply because of some of the allegations in the indictment describe conduct that could be considered part of a judge's job. Even if a more limited version of judicial immunity exists, it does not support dismissal of the instant indictment. So, in short, she was trying to argue that her lawyers are trying to argue that she's allowed to run her own courtroom as she sees fit. This federal judge said no, so the case will proceed.
When she was first charged, I heard from people saying that she had two best options. One, draw Lynn Edelman. He is a former Democratic lawmaker, one of the liberal members, if not the most liberal member of the federal judiciary in Wisconsin, that he'd be most sympathetic to her arguments. The fact that he rejected her motion to dismiss, not great for her. The second option was drag it out as long as you can. The reason being that Trump will be in office until early 2029, barring something I'm not aware of with the Constitution. And the next administration might not be interested in this case. It might not care about these things. So the Trump folks are not going to drop this. The next president might. So for Dugan, can you now draw this out through appeals, the Seventh Circuit, U.S. Supreme Court, to make this thing go until 2029 and then possibly go away? Don't forget, she has a legal defense fund. We won't find out like that often how much is in there, but we're waiting to see, is it becoming a national cause? Is she raising lots of money through it that can fund this offense? Because she has a very high-profile defense team helping her out. They're not there to like plea bargain, people argue. So, and also, the Trump administration probably doesn't want a plea bargain. They want to show a show of force saying, you will not impede what we're trying to do if you're a judge or public official.
So her attorneys have expressed confidence that, you know, she will do fine at a criminal trial, for example. But it does have echoes of this case from the first Trump administration in Massachusetts, a judge who also let a person out of her courtroom. And that case is actually ongoing. And so, like you say, it could be drawn out for quite a bit of time. In the very short term, there will be a scheduling conference next week. So that's the immediate next step. Also out of a high court, out of the Supreme Court, there was a ruling on NIH grants. And I touched upon this last week, but I actually kind of conflated two cases. So there are a number of cases involving the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is the largest funder of biomedical research in the country. One has to do with grants that have been terminated based on having to do with DEI or sexuality or COVID-19, that kind of thing. That's the one that this case touches on. There's a separate one about overhead costs. Wisconsin's DOJ has been involved in both. And so there was a ruling out of the Supreme Court on the DEI grant-related case that basically it's a complicated ruling, and we'll get to what these jurors said. But the end result is that the NIH can terminate grants that were ended for violating these sort of administrative preferences around DEI language, researching health impacts on different ethnic or racial groups or sexual groups, studying, again, COVID-19, AIDS, working in China. A lower court had previously ruled that the criteria for cancellation was discriminatory and said that the NIH would have to release those funds. In the SCOTUS ruling, it was a split ruling, they found that the criteria is, in fact, illegal, but no, the grants do not have to then be released, and that further challenges to these grant cancellations have to go through contract court. And so there was quite a bit of sort of back and forth between a number of different sort of concurrences and dissents because there are so many different aspects to it. From Justice Brett Kavanaugh, it is not evident that plaintiffs' challenge to the guidance is separable from their challenge to the grant terminations, but even if it is, plaintiffs are unlikely to succeed on the merits of their arbitrary and capricious challenge to the guidance. So again, all the different kind of components of these cases. And then Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. This is Calvin Ball jurisprudence with a twist. Calvin Ball has only one rule. There are no fixed rules. We seem to have two, that one, and this administration always wins. So it's a reference to Calvin and Hobbes, the game that's played in there. The Trump administration is claiming this as a victory. It's going to continue, but the impact here in Wisconsin in the immediate, I found at least 40 grants affected, $14.3 million in biomedical research alone at the University of Wisconsin. It will end current funding or current projects that are already in motion. And the argument also is that if now these grants have to be challenged in contract court, how many institutions actually have the resources to kind of individually challenge their right to use each of these grants? Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of Supreme Court news for us all. And again, the way that kind of federal policy continues to resonate here. And speaking of, we also have a little bit of an update on FEMA in Milwaukee. So Governor Evers requested a presidential disaster declaration on Wednesday. Yesterday, the congressional delegation, all Republicans and Democrats together, sent a letter affirming that they would like this. J.D. Vance yesterday said that the president doesn't know about it, but he will re-up the ask. So what would that declaration do for Milwaukee and other counties?
Opens the door to federal aid. It's the last step. And also, this is the president's sole authority, sole discretion to issue this declaration. So it's Trump or nothing, essentially, for Wisconsin.
So we will kind of see what that does. And who knows, like, whether the questions that were asked directly of the vice president, whether he will kind of elevate that, but it's always interesting to see our congressional delegation communicating with each other and working together. That brings us to the stock report. Rising this week is factory farm regulations.
So confined animal feeding operations, i.e. CAFOs, i.e. factory farms, in the news, appeals court ruled that the Department of Natural Resources have the authority, explicit authority, to require these operations to have wastewater permits before discharging wastewater into a navigable body of water. Now, if you know anything about Wisconsin courts, if you are conservative and you want to try and get a good ruling from an appeals court, you go to the second district based out of Waukesha. Not that judges are in for political or you know their leanings, but there are three of the four judges there are conservative, pretty conservative. You got your best bet. You'll always have a conservative majority in that panel, and you're likely your best bet for a favorable hearing. The fact the second district was unanimous in saying no, you know, as authority is noteworthy. It also plays out as this backdrop against these regulations, right, these rules. There's ongoing discussion about what's going to be next with the rules process because Evers administration is trying to push forward getting rules published without going through committees, Republicans looking for options. So that's the backdrop of this, but this is a big win for environmentalists and the DNR and its authority.
And then mixed this week, we talked a little bit about Republicans needing to revamp their election strategy for springtime elections. They released a report, a kind of post-mortem of those April elections.
So I got a hold of this thing last Friday. It was circulated to party members. Basically, the argument is the way to fix things is to make the party a bigger part of campaigns, give them more money, and for the party to raise more money. Now, let's take them in different pieces. So under state law in Wisconsin, political parties can take in unlimited contributions and make unlimited transfers to candidates. That's a big deal because candidates get a better rate on TV ads, broadcast TV ads, than outside groups do. Go back to the Supreme Court race this past spring. I tracked $115 million spent. Brad Schimmel on his side had a bit of an advantage, you know, several million dollars, give or take. But Susan Crawford had more money through her campaign on TV, almost pretty much 2-1 over Schimmel. That's a big deal because even though she was outspent by the overall conservative coalition, the campaign, her and her side, she had more points on air over the closing weeks to combat the conservative message. So that's a big deal. Democrats have been much better about donors giving big donations to the state party flowing to their candidates for Supreme Court. $10 million to Protasiewicz in 23, 11 and change to Crawford this year. Now, Schimmel, no slouch, you got $9 million from the state GOP, but the conservative money still flows through outside groups. There are a couple reasons for that. One, all these groups have their own, like, kind of backer financially. One, some don't like other names in campaign finance reports because then you are known that you're doing this. Two, they like their operation. They want to try and, like, focus there. So the party's got to make this argument of, you should give us more money, which you have to give the donors confidence in what you're doing to get more money. The state GOP has got a little problem right now. Perception, they're not raising money in a healthy clip. They laid off four field staffers a few weeks ago. Now, they did it, they say, because they were there for the 24 election. That time had passed. It was time to kind of like ramp down operations. But when you're fighting perception, you're not raising enough money and you lay off field staff, not a great look, right? And all these other things going on, a lot of the report was like, well, no duh. You know, we know, you know, that you need to raise more money. We know we need to get more out-of-state donations. Why aren't you talking to the fact that we don't win when Trump's not on the ballot? How do we fix that? That's an elephant in the room. How do you inspire confidence as a party in what you're doing? Where's the vision? That was kind of missing in the report. So a lot of the stuff is kind of like, yeah, you know, okay, we get that, but we're missing something.
So definitely some proof will be in the pudding in April, although who knows what's going to happen then, and then again in November. And that brings us kind of quickly to falling, or 'tis the season for another false electors update. Jim Troupas.
So last Friday, a Dane County judge dismissed the motion to dismiss, rejected the motion to dismiss from Troupas and two others, worked for Trump. They wanted these charges dismissed. There are 11 felony counts basically for participating in this scheme to present an alternate set of electors in the presidential race, saying that Trump won Wisconsin in 2020 rather than Joe Biden. Now, if you're Jim Troupas, you're looking at the fact that you're going to go to trial now, barring something else happening, in Dane County. Pretty liberal Dane County. That's not a great opportunity for you. If you appeal, ultimately you'll go to the state Supreme Court, liberal majority. That's not great for you. So it's a bit of a challenge for him right now where he's going to go. And now, I'm not a lawyer, so I always say I'm not going to argue who's right or wrong or what's justified, but there is some conservative outrage that Call filed these charges in the first place because they say Call, or that Troupas is just representing Donald Trump. Others will say, look, he didn't just represent Trump in court. He went out of his way to try and get the alternate slate to Ron Johnson, then to the vice president. That's beyond being a lawyer in court. That's being a participant in the scheme. Again, that's for a court to decide. Challenge for him. Also got to mention quick, Josh Call is going to play a role in his election in 2026, whether he runs for election as AG or runs for governor. Remains to be seen, but something to keep an eye on.
All right, well, that'll do it for this week. I am Anyvan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Have a great long holiday weekend.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.